Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired the first show of the new year, the 10th anniversary of the Tech Guy show, January 4th, 2014. This is episode 1045. Enjoy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, and it's time for the Tech Guy show. This is the show where we talk about computers and the internet and smartphones and home theater and all that jazz, everything with a chip in it, and answer your questions and help you buy. I like to say, in a very poetic way, we help you choose it. We help you abuse it. We help you use it. Then we help you lose it. With the full life cycle of personal consumer electronics, we do it all. Heather Hammond, the Phone Ranger, is here.
The arc of life.
It is. The circle of digital life. Choose it, use it, abuse it, and huh?
Your singing voice sounds wonderful.
No, it doesn't. I tweeted this morning a picture of me looking like a Shar-Pei. I did something very stupid. I took NyQuil twice. Once,
whoops.
And it worked really well. It wasn't that I forgot. I took it once, went to, because, you know, this cold. Everybody's got it, right? It's lingering. It goes on for weeks. I didn't help things by spending a New Year's Eve broadcasting for 24 straight, actually 23 straight
and
hours.
All those people around kissing you, and you got sick.
Yeah, no tongue in the future. That was a bad idea.
That
no, I don't think that's where. I got sick because I got sick like 2 weeks before that. This is this lingering cold. I think it's a winter, you know, cold everybody's getting.
Really?
But anyway, we had fun. I'm sorry you weren't here on our New Year's Eve. We had so much fun.
I felt like I was a little bit. I did watch.
Did you tune in?
Mm-hmm. For a little while. I was even in the chat room.
I wanted to kind of be like a rockin' New Year's Eve geek style.
Exactly.
So we said hello. We actually did countdowns. We started, I can't remember what the first place was. We literally went around the world with countdowns.
What was the first place? I can't think. Bali,
well,
Bali.
We
no.
started in 4 a.m. and
Bora Bora?
I don't remember.
To
it's
Maria?
Been a long time. New Zealand was the first? Was that, but we didn't have somebody from New Zealand. I think Australia was the first. Sydney.
Anyway, it was geeky. I saw some geeky dancing going on.
There was dancing. We had a New Orleans-style jazz band.
They told me
they can equally play celebratory and funeral marches. I said, well, you could play at my funeral, but right now let's try the celebratory. Although we did play a funeral march for 2013. We said goodbye 2013.
Oh, okay. I thought funeral and celebration was the same thing in New Orleans because it's like, woohoo,
it is.
Had a great life.
It's a little slower. It's a little more mournful in the funeral thing. But it's a march. It's fun. We had a magic act. We had Brian Brushwood, who's a brilliant, bizarre magician out of Austin, Texas, and one of our hosts on our podcast network, did an amazing fire breathing. He hammered a nail into his nose. He did some ESP. Just really incredible.
Were there bunny rabbits?
He's not that kind of magician.
Oh.
If there were a bunny rabbit, it would be bad. We would like roast it and eat it. It wouldn't be a good bunny rabbit. It's bizarre magic. We also did, what else did we do? Oh, we played Artemis. That was fun. Somebody in the chat room reminded us. Artemis is a game where this guy Wes came in and he set up a server and we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people plus a captain, 6 people running the Starship Enterprise, except it's a Starship Artemis. And there's a navigator and a comms officer. There's a captain. And you each played the role like on the bridge of Star Trek. And then you get attacked and you have to defend yourself. And as I was a terrible captain. You tried, and it was fun. That was really fun. We played that a few times. We have a game we call Game of Geeks where, you know, it helped me doing the Tech Guy show. It was very helpful. I won the first round because we had a tech call. And we had some of our other hosts, like Steve Gibson, who's our security guy. And the first thing he says, is it a Mac or a PC? And Gam Gam, the victim who was having trouble with her computer, said it's a Mac. And he said, well, I can't help you. that was the end of that one. It was so much fun. Scott Wilkinson was here, our home theater guru. He danced. His wife, Joanna, came. So, yeah, it was really Happy New Year, everybody.
So you are doing this again next year.
Yeah, we decided. Not 24 hours this time. Maybe only 12. But it was fun. You know, we had so much stuff. I learned how to fight with a lightsaber. Did you see that part?
I did not.
There's a group in San Francisco that does, well, they call it theatrical or stage combat.
Right.
But they came with lightsabers and Jedi cloaks, and they were all dressed up in their Jedi outfits. And see, we did a lot of geeky stuff.
I thought you already knew how to fight.
Apparently, I'm pretty good.
Yay. That's what I would expect.
There's a picture of me as Darth Leo.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I think I acquitted myself well. They may have another opinion. It was a lot of fun. I hope you had a great New Year's Eve, all of you, and enjoyed yourself. Now here we are in 2014. It's going to be an interesting year. I think 2013, despite articles in places like QZ.com, Quartz, where they said, this is a terrible year for tech, blah, 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 blah. Nobody got anything out of it. There was no innovation. And you know, this is kind of something you can say almost every year. It's all about commercial stuff, not about not about true innovation, blah, blah, blah. I don't buy it. Here I am as a Jedi Knight, by the way, fighting in our kitchen behind the scenes. I'm the red sword. I'm actually Darth Maul. In fact, my face looks even a little red.
That's awesome.
I think 2014 is going to be a very interesting year. If Apple does an iWatch, and everybody who watches Apple says they will, this will be the year Apple will release it. There's a lot of question in my mind about what this iWatch might be. See, the big category, I think the big... you got to understand the thinking of Silicon Valley. They're always looking for the next new big thing. Little incremental steps, they don't care. Gradual improvement over time, that's not what motivates them. They want to change the world, boom, in a big step, like Apple did with the iPod and the iPhone and the iPad. That's the model. Can we release a product that everybody's going to say, wow? Microsoft Windows. We go way back, the Apple II computer, the very first spreadsheet, VisiCalc. These were products that completely changed everything. With a stroke of a pen, and of course, as a result, made millions and millions of dollars. And that's, we don't talk about it, but that's a secondary motivation, I think, is, you get filthy rich. And, I think a lot of the attention, and maybe you could say that 2013 was kind of a junky year, because a lot of the attention was on making money in apps. The fact that Instagram sold for $1 billion probably inspired a lot of young people going out of college to say, I'm going to write the next big app. And in fact, the founders of Snapchat did exactly that. They were frat brothers at Stanford a few years ago, literally just a couple of years ago, created Snapchat and made a company they believe was so valuable they were able to turn down a $3 billion offer just a few months ago. I just saw a venture capitalist say it's going to be worth $100 billion. It was the right thing to do. Whoa. So naturally, that draws a lot of resources away from hardware and creating things to creating software, which isn't a bad thing. Software always lags behind hardware. But I do think this is going to be the year where, if wearables are going to take off. So everybody's looking, as an explanation, so that's what Silicon Valley's looking for. The next big thing. And what is it going to be? Is it going to be speech input? Is it going to be self-driving cars? I think we've all settled. It may be home automation. That would be good. But I think we've all settled. There'll be stuff in all of those arenas, robots. But the consensus seems to be it's going to be wearables. Now, I, in my opinion, a smartphone is a wearable, right? You carry it in your pocket. It's always with you. It's always connected to the internet. The computers in these are fast enough now that you can run, real programs that do real things. I think smartphones are amazing. They're the most interesting area. In fact, 2013 was the year of the smartphone, in my opinion. But that's not good enough for these guys. They say, no, because you got to take it out of your pocket. It's got to be something you could just, look through your glasses or lift up your arm. Google's going with the glasses. They think it's going to be, some sort of display. I think Google's close, but not quite. I think it needs to be, this will be controversial, a heads-up display. So the way Google Glass works, it's just a little frame you wear like glasses. They're not glasses. They don't cover your eyes. And the top of the frame over your right eye has a little screen that you can look up into. That's Google's solution. I don't want to look up into it. I want to look straight through it. a heads-up display. Apple says wristwatch, we believe, and that'll be this year. Let's talk more about it. Your call's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is going to be the year of desktop Linux. Finally, Linux on the desktop will take off. No. But see, that's what's interesting about all this, because for years we said that. Never happened. But what did happen? Linux became the most used operating system via Android. So, in a way, it did. I could do a goat scream right now. But it would be the last thing I would say. There's nothing, you know, here we are, it's January 4th. You can't really, I mean, there's nothing kind of more sad than 3 days after New Year's when you're still wearing a funny hat and blowing the noisemakers. That's sad.
It happens sometimes.
Ringing the cowbell.
That's why you always take sunglasses out with you when you go out at night.
I got those too.
You never know.
Did we, we swept the confetti off the floor though, didn't we?
Yeah, but it does appear that there's some champagne spilled on my keyboard.
Yeah.
Yes.
We went through, so somebody found a real deal on champagne.
Oh.
Was that you, Jeff? Cooks, there were magnums, big, one and a half liter magnums of Cook's champagne. How much a bottle was that? $6 a bottle. So we got a bunch. And,
I don't like to hear the word real deal in the same
champagne,
sentence.
It's not
with
a good
champagne.
It's not a felicitous, no. But the good news is we had enough of it. We had enough bottles to pop one every hour.
Nice.
In fact, I didn't know this. I mean, this was also a real lesson in the time zones of the world. Bizarre. We just should eliminate time zones entirely. Just bizarre. There are places that are a quarter after, half past, quarter of. In 24 hours, there were something like 27 time zones. And then it turns out you can't do it, even though the Earth revolves once on its axis once every 24 hours. So that's the maximum length of a day. Somehow, through the magic of time zones, there are 25 hours of New Year's Eves. Because it turns out, I can't remember. I don't want to name names. Was it Samoa, American Samoa, New Zealand? Somebody decided, no, we want to be where the day begins. So they kind of... Time zones, you know, would normally be longitudinal lines that go from North Pole to South Pole across the globe. But this one, there's a little jut where to include this island, Baker Islands or whatever, so that they get to be the place the day begins.
And they want to say, we're special. Yeah. Okay.
It's 50 people on an island and with a bunch of sheep. I don't know what is out there. But anyway, it was fun. It was fun. We had a good time. And I'm sorry you weren't here, but I'm glad you watched a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was such a success, we're going to do it again. So if you want to see the tech guy in a tuxedo, you're going to have to wait a year. This is an important day. I just want to make one more thing, and then we're going to get to the phones. This is the 10th anniversary of the Tech Guy Show.
Ta-da!
So on this day, in 2003, before tech began, no, 2004, I'm sorry. What are you trying to blow your horn? I'm telling you, there's nothing sadder than 3 days after New Year's still using the paraphernalia. Here, have my cowbell.
Yay!
Actually, every radio show should have a cowbell.
Don't let other radio shows know.
Like the morning guy.
Time to get up, Petaluma.
Baker Island. What was I saying?
That it's our 10th anniversary.
Thank you. NyQuil is not completely cleared. I didn't even finish that story. I took it, went to go to bed, slept very nicely. It worked very well. Then I took another one. I thought, this is good. I started coughing at 5 in the morning, so I said, I'll have some more. But forgetting that, in fact, I had to be on the radio a scant 4 hours, 5 hours after that, and that wasn't a good thing.
Oh,
so if I'm a little foggy, you'll understand why. This is why I cannot complete a thought. 10 years. It was. I meant to send her flowers. I will send her this week. It was 10 years ago this day that Robin Bertolucci, the program director, still to this day program director at KFI in Los Angeles. And by the way, that alone tells you how good she is. Mm-hmm. When a program director lasts 10 years in the hottest market, the most competitive market in the world, Los Angeles, you know she's good. And so she had the good sense to hire me to do a weekend call-in radio show, something I'd been doing for many years before that. I've actually been the tech guy in spirit, if not name, since 91. But she called me up. We'd worked together in San Francisco at the great KGO, and she'd call me up and said, would you like to be the tech guy on KFI? I said, because it rhymes. See, that's why, by the way. It rhymes. I'm the tech guy on KFI.
The suit fit.
The suit fit. Pretty much that's exactly right. The suit fit, the chair conformed. So I took the job. And here we are 10 years later still doing it. And you know what's great is that the reason I know this is because our chat room moderator, Dan Hendricks, sent me an email saying, you know, it's been 10 years, and sent me the original email where I asked him, would you like to be our moderator for our chat room?
Wow.
That's amazing that he's still doing that. That's amazing. That's a tough job running that chat room. Anyway, 10 years, and here we are still doing it. And, you know, God and the computer industry willing, we got many more years ahead. I don't think it's going to get any easier. I don't think it's going to get any more straightforward. I think people are going to always need help with technology, don't you think? It just gets crazier and crazier, frankly. I thought by now, oh, it'll be, you know, you turn it on, it'll just work. Mm-hmm. Boy, was I wrong. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5. I still don't know the phone number after 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Outside those areas, please use your Skype, and we will be able to reach you and at no cost and no obligation. So you have lined up 5-6 fabulous calls. Which one should I start with?
I'm just so excited that Jonathan in West Covina was our first call of the new year.
Hello, Jonathan in West Covina. Happy 2014.
Hey, Leo. Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you.
I got an issue. I got two outputs out of my, one output out of my receiver, and I'm sending one output to the TV and one to my projector, but somehow my HDMI splitter doesn't work when both things are on.
Ugh. Don't get me started on that. So my recommendation, HDMI splitters, the idea is, of course, that you would like to have two different sets. But the HDMI splitter, to me, has always been a challenge, and I've tried a variety of them. Who makes your HDMI splitter?
I bought it online. Came from China. I don't know who made it.
Yeah. They're all made in China. So that's a fair answer. You know, it's probably just can only do one screen at a time. I mean, that's a lot to do. The better way to do this, well, I was going to say an AV receiver, but in many cases, an AV receiver can't feed two HDMIs at the same
time.
Right. Splitters, HDMI splitters are a real kind of
pain.
We use the word kludge, which means, you know, it kind of works, but it kind of doesn't. I think part of the problem might be copy protection, among other things. In order for HDMI to work with high-def content, Hollywood has decreed it has to support something called HDCP, high-def copy protection. And everything, not just the computer or the player, not just your Blu-ray player, but everything along the chain, including your screen, has to be HDCP compliant.
No.
So that could be one thing, and it may even be that HDCP says, I see two things, you can't only do it once. So I'm looking in the chat room, and many of them are saying, yeah, the very few splitters seem very funky. We will put a link in the show notes, techguylabs.com, to some powered HDMI splitters that might work better. And an AV receiver with two outputs might also be a better choice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Digital images are very delicate. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru, is with us. He joins us every week to talk about home theater. And of course, this is going to be a big week for Scotty. He's going down to the consumer. Oh, I'm not allowed to say it that way. See, we're supposed to. We got a letter from the lawyers at the CES, folks, this Consumer Electronics Association, which is still the Consumer Electronics Association, saying we don't want you to call CES the Consumer Electronics Show. We want you to just say International CES. It stands for nothing.
Which is not true.
No, and in fact, if I don't call it the Consumer Electronics Show, people who are not in the know, which means everybody, will say, what is it?
What is it? Exactly. So, I have no trouble calling it the Consumer Electronics Show.
So coming on Tuesday, the geeks will descend on Las Vegas, Nevada, nearly 200,000 strong. It is the last big consumer, you know, the last big kind of digital trade show in the United States.
Yep.
And it proceeds successfully every year. Everybody goes, and hundreds of thousands of products will be shown, not all of which will be released, as we've learned. Sometimes you see stuff that doesn't come out. The idea of International CES is to bring manufacturers together with dealers so the dealers can see what's going to be new for 2014, order it oftentimes for the fall of this year.
Right, right. But then there are those. Then there are the concept products. You know, when you go to a car show and you see the concept cars, those are never going to be released.
Right.
They're just showing you what they can do. And last year we saw that with 4K OLED TVs.
They were just teasing us.
They were. They were just teasing us. Now, someday that may, in fact, be released. And we may see more of it this year at CES, but hard to say. We'll find out.
I should just explain.
Yes, please.
What a 4K OLED is.
Talk about alphabet.
I would like a 4K OLED. It's a new form of screen. We've had LCDs for a long time.
Right.
And sometimes you'll see it written as LED. That just is a LED backlit LCD.
Correct.
We've had plasma, although plasma seems to be dying out.
We think it's on its way out, yeah.
We've seen other technologies trying to replace that. The original TVs were CRTs, cathode ray tubes. So the new form, the new thing that's going to be very hot, I think.
The next big thing.
Is organic light-emitting diodes. This is display technology that actually can be printed, which is weird.
Yep.
And if right now they're very expensive. They have some advantages. OLED TVs have very good contrast ratios. The blacks are
super
effectively
good.
Off. It's dark. Not true
exactly.
On an LCD. Are they pretty fast, too? Because that was one problem with the...
Well, yes and no. The response time of the individual pixels, how fast they can turn on and off, is very, very fast.
Ah.
In the microsecond range. But there's a caveat, and the caveat is that they still use a technique for displaying each frame called sample and hold. And LCD TVs do the same thing. And then what that basically means is each frame is held on the screen for the entire duration of the frame. And that can, in fact, still lead to motion blur, which is a problem in LCDs. Now, why OLED manufacturers didn't come up with a different way to do that, I don't know. And, you know, I'll ask around and see if I can find some answer to that. But that is a puzzlement to me.
Well, okay. And then, okay, so that's OLED. And
that's
then 4K
OLED.
Is another kind of new thing that's happening. In fact, we're seeing a lot of rock-bottom, inexpensive 4K displays already.
It's amazing.
These are twice, in theory, roughly, really we should use the term the industry uses, Ultra HD or UHD. They're roughly
correct.
Twice the resolution horizontally and vertically, hence
correct,
4K.
Which means four times the number of pixels of an HD TV.
There are there's lots of little footnotes to that. So let's just say UHD or Ultra HD. Will we see Ultra HD TVs in the marketplace?
Yes, we already do.
We do.
They're
we see
already
quite
here.
A few. Will we see Ultra HD content?
That's the big question. One of two big questions in my mind is where's the content? You know, like that old commercial, where's the beep? Well, where's the content?
So at CES, you expect to see 4K displays. You expect to see OLEDs. Yep. You expect to see, will we see 4K OLED? Because I have an OLED. I kind of bit the bullet and bought an OLED speaker. They're very expensive.
You did. But
just to see what the future is like. And it's very nice. Lisa and I were watching it last night. It's not so much nicer that you go, oh, gosh, I'm going to throw my plasma out or I can't go watch the plasma. In fact, I'll probably watch the football games this afternoon on the plasmas.
Right. So it's bigger for one thing.
It's bigger. But it looks good. It's very nice.
Yeah. Well, as far as content is concerned, 4K content, we are going to see more of that, and I expect to see quite a bit of that at CES. Netflix, I just got an email today that from somebody that had linked to an article that Netflix is going to be streaming the next episode of the next season of House of Cards in 4K or Ultra HD.
Will it be available to everyone?
Well, not in that resolution. Only people with Ultra HD TVs will be able to see it in that resolution.
And lots of
bandwidth. Available in that resolution.
And lots of bandwidth because I don't know what the bandwidth's going to be for that, but I could tell you that the highest quality right now bandwidth that Netflix will use, if you do HD, is 2.8 gigabytes per hour. That's faster than most people have at home.
Right.
Gigabytes, not bits. So per hour. So, I mean, that's a lot of data, and it sustains throughput, and most people can't even sustain that. So I don't know what UHD.
So I don't know. I agree with you entirely. I think streaming 4K or Ultra HD is going to be really problematic for many, many people. The U.S., you know, lags behind some of the rest of the world anyway in terms of per capita bandwidth available into the home, as you know. So that is going to be a challenge for delivering this new higher resolution over the internet. Now,
So let's not get too mired in that. We've talked about it before. Yeah. What else do you expect at CES? What else should we be looking for?
The two big things that I think are going to be really important at CES. One is, and I know you won't be too excited about this, but glasses-free 3D.
Oh, no, I'm excited about it. I just don't believe it. If they did it, I would be. That's one of my big complaints about 3D.
Is glasses. Okay, yeah. Well, then you're going to be pleasantly surprised because I've actually seen demos of the two competing technologies that are going to be shown at CES. And at CES, they're going to actually announce OEM partners, original equipment manufacturers, manufacturers like Panasonic or Toshiba. I don't know who they are yet, but companies like that who are going to be producing glasses-free 3D TVs from Dolby technology or from another smaller company called Stream TV Networks.
Well, this would be the holy grail, frankly, but
it would.
I am still skeptical, so I'll look with interest to see what you say when you see
this.
What we've seen in the past is TV where you have to stand in a certain spot. This is called a lenticular. See, here's the problem with 3D. You've got to get different pictures to each eye.
Right.
The reason the glasses work is you can make the glasses polarized, or in the older days, you'd have them different colors, and so they could see, the eyes could look at one picture, one eye would see one part of it, the other eye would see the other part of it. Take off the glasses, we're looking at the same screen.
Right.
It's very difficult to think of a technology that would allow one screen to display different images into two different eyes without something in between.
I would say exactly the same thing, and if I hadn't seen it for myself, I would be very skeptical.
I mean, all I could think of is some sort of eye tracking technology and laser, you know, because one eye can't see what the other eye's seeing.
That's right, and they've worked out some way to.
No,
do that.
There's no way. Scott Wilkinson, we'll find out next week. AVSforum.com, and that's where he writes. He joins us each week for his Home Theater Geek podcast. Have a great time at CES. We'll talk next week.
You bet.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Here's a question with glasses-free 3D.
Yeah.
Would it work with one eye?
I don't think so.
Ask him that.
Up with the phrase.
I will. It's actually an excellent question. But you really need...
I think it would have to work with one eye, or otherwise I don't understand how it works. It's got to be... No, I mean, that's like psychoacoustics, where you can simulate stereo with psychoacoustics, right, or surround with psychoacoustics. Because otherwise you have to that's why lenticular works. Lenticular uses prisms and that's why you have to stand in a specific spot to split the single display like the old 3D comics, the Mad Magazine, where you'd tilt it. That's exactly how lenticular works. And I think these are lenticular. There's no way. I don't understand.
There is an element of – there is a lenticular screen.
Of course
there,
lenticular.
Yes. However, they're doing some very sophisticated processing to prevent that lock. You must lock your head in a particular location.
Makes no sense.
Okay, well, I'm going to
Makes no
it out
sense.
I'm
it's not possible.
It
it's
week.
Like traveling faster than the speed of light. It's not possible. Not possible. The only way you could do it is, I'm not kidding, with lasers and eye tracking technology that would fire different beams into different eyes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to have to wear glasses. You're just going to have to. So you say you've actually seen this in action?
I've seen it. I've seen it, and it's remarkable.
And you can move around and tilt your head and all that stuff?
Yep. You sure can. It's amazing. So, anyway.
I don't get how it could possibly work. Anyway, Scott. All right. Yeah, you're on the phone, I won't keep you on because that's probably a pain in the ass. But
No. It's not a problem. By the way, I just wanted to mention you had that caller before with the HDMI splitter.
Yeah.
Your answer was completely correct, but there's another factor, and that is if the two displays are different in some fundamental way, like, for example, if they have different resolutions.
Yeah, how's it going
to
do it?
The EDID coming back from the display to the switcher is confusing the switcher. It's like, which one do I do?
Yeah, I had that problem with my AV receiver when I was using a projector. I don't know why he wants both screens on at once. That's kind of odd.
Normally you would.
Yeah.
You'd have the projector for when you want to watch a big movie or a big sports thing, and then you'd retract the screen and use the plasma for more casual viewing.
I had the worst trouble when I would switch back and forth because the receiver got very confused.
I'd
have to shut everything down, replug, just because, just to tell the receiver. So you, Jeff, you have simultaneously two different screens, both on HDMI?
Ah, Mike Heiss in the chat room is saying they usually default to the lowest resolution.
Right. Jeff says he's using a mono price switch and it works. Not simultaneously.
Yeah, somebody else in the chat room said a switch or a splitter.
Well, this guy said an HDMI splitter because that's splitter, so we could have two screens. So you're using an HDMI splitter.
Right.
He has a matrix.
Ooh. but a bunch of people in the chat room mentioned Monoprice as being one that works, and that's good. You had trouble even with your receiver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing.
It's a difficult proposition. I agree. Anyway, next week I will also probably be on the phone because I'll still be in Vegas.
It's perfectly fine. I don't have a problem with you on the phone. Okay. Cell phone's not good. If you get a landline, that's always better.
Well, I'm on a cell phone now. I'll try and make it on
a landline. It sounded fine, but it's just always risky because it could break in and break up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Okay,
all right, I'm going to run.
Next week.
Thanks. All right, thanks, Scott.
Bye.
You bet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. The website, techguylabs.com. Jeffrey Needles, I don't know, what's your title, Jeffrey? Man About Town, says that he works here, I don't know in what capacity, frankly, but he says that he uses a monoprice matrix to drive two different HDMI displays simultaneously, and it works. Of course, the issue is going to be if the displays have different resolutions, that's going to really confuse, because the output device is probably only able to send one. Are they the same resolution, Jeff, or are they separate? They are the same. So that's the best thing to do is if you've got the same resolution. And we'll put a link in the show notes to the monoprice matrix. It's a 4x2 matrix as opposed to a splitter or a switcher. It does both effectively. So how much was that? Monoprice is cheap, probably $100. Yeah, something like that. A little less. All right. Dr. Mom in our chat room says, Jeff is the chief Lego wrangler here at the Brickhouse Studios. Yes, that's true, but he does so much more. He's a spreadsheet wrangler. Where is the Tower Bridge that you built over? So one of the things we did during our New Year's Eve party is we had a giant 4,500-piece Lego set that Jeff, who I guess in his youth, his misspent youth, was a Lego master. Did you compete? Were you in tournaments? Anyway, he said, I'm going to build this. And I thought, wow, it's going to take him all 24 hours. It did not. In fact, Jeff is one of those guys, very cocky. He kind of started it and then got, yeah. And he waited to like the last hour and built it all at once. It was really rather remarkable, Jeff. So now our conference room has a giant tower bridge made out of Lego. I don't know what to do with it. He can't put it in his carry-on. Goes back to college. When do you go back to school?
Tomorrow.
Thank God. Tomorrow night. No, we like to tease Jeff. We like to tease Jeff. He is studying at Northeastern and is a very good student. John, let's go to the Poconos. Wouldn't you like to go to the Poconos now, right now, where it's probably, how many feet of snow, John?
About 6 inches.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
No, it's more of the cold.
Oh, come on. Bucket up. You live in the Poconos. Is this your vacation home, or do you live up there?
No, I live here.
It's beautiful. I love the Poconos. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Today's better than yesterday. It was about 22 today. Yesterday, single digits.
Ooh. Yeah. Oof. Balmy now. What can I do for you, John?
Yeah, I have a question about the Internet Archive. I usually use it to look at books and find music and video, but I also found the software section. And I was wondering if some of that software is legal to download.
It's an interesting story with the Internet Archive. A guy named Brewster Kahle, who made some money selling his company Waze to AOL, decided to spend that money in a very, I think, altruistic way. He said, I'm going to make... The Internet is hugely important. It is a record of life in the 21st century, but we're not saving it. So I'm going to make an archive, Internet Archive. It's at archive.org, and we will attempt to save the Internet, like to hard drives, and they do terabytes a day. They have the Wayback Machine, which lets you browse to previous websites. It's incredibly useful. And as you mentioned, you see, if you go to archive.org, you'll see the web, but you also see video, texts, audio, and software.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have asked Brewster, what about, what's the story with copyright? Because he said, look, we're a library. Libraries don't have to worry about copyright, right? Libraries store everything. He said, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But what's more important is to save all this stuff. Now, I'm looking here. There's Atari 7800 stuff, Coleco stuff. Remember the old ColecoVision game machine? That was awesome. Computer.
Yeah.
There's
2600.
Yeah. There's a lot of great stuff and hundreds of thousands of downloads of all of this stuff, including the E.T. game that Atari thought was so bad they buried it in a landfill in New Mexico. You can actually run, you can go to archive.org and run the E.T. game in browser emulation as if you're playing the game on an Atari 2600. Now, I am sure that Atari, which still exists, and whoever owns the rights to E.T., Steven Spielberg or whoever, you know, this is copyright. And but I think they also feel like this is a library. So I think Brewster's attitude is this is a library. We're doing public service. If they didn't save this stuff, who would? Right?
Yeah.
So I would not feel guilty about this. Nobody's going to make any money off of this E.T. game or any of the other stuff.
There's a section, though, where you can actually, like, download them, like, using emulators. And that was the part I was kind of wondering about.
Well, the game industry's always said, we're not cool with this.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to things like MAME, you know, you probably know about MAME, which is the arcade emulation. It's really wonderful. Lets you play all those old arcade games. Now, MAME is open source and free and available, and that's not illegal. But if you want to play any games on MAME, like the original, you know, Battle Zone or something, you have to download the ROM, and those are still in copyright. My opinion is... feel completely ethical and conscience-free about using this stuff. It's something that the industry is going to have to work out with the Internet Archive because, right now they're ignoring it, and I think they should because it's a library preserving our history.
Yeah.
And you may laugh. You may say, E.T., come on. Is that our – it is our history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as dumb and as dopey as it is, it's a history of – of 1982, and the game industry. So my opinion is, and I applaud Brewster Kahle for just saying, damn the copyright lawyers, full speed ahead, and copying the internet because in years to come, this is going to be an amazing archive. And had he not done this, this would all be lost. This Atari E.T. game would be in the landfill, and that's that. So I'm really glad that he's doing it. I think you can download anything on there, I would say, download without feeling too guilty about it. You're not – who's losing money because of this? Nobody. You can't buy this software.
Mm-hmm.
It passes to me the fair use test, which is it's not of economic harm in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great social benefit. And as somebody in the chat room said, they got enough of my quarters when I was a kid.
I've even bought the collections, like the modern Atari collections and stuff, to play on like the PlayStation.
Me too. Those of us of a certain age are very nostalgic about this stuff. We grew up with this. This is the howdy doody of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applaud your thinking about this. Most people don't even, they just go, yeah, cool, I can get this for free. So I applaud you thinking about it, and that's what's going on.
All right, well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, actually, and I hope you stay warm up there in the Poconos. It's so beautiful up there.
Yeah.
You got a nice wood fire going? And
no.
Aw. Well, that's probably these days you can't do that anymore, can you? It pollutes the air and all that stuff. Thank you, John. Stay warm.
Yep. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And just, a golf clap round of applause to Brewster Kahle, because he's backing up the internet. And he says, we're not going to worry about the copyrights on this, because, in 100 years, nobody's going to care. And they will be glad indeed that we saved it. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, cell phones, all that stuff, smartphones. I don't really want to talk about, Nokia 100s or anything like that. Smartphones. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Otherwise, just use Skype. Still won't cost you anything. Look at that. Somebody brought me the cartridge of the Atari ET game that we were talking about last hour.
Wow.
This is unopened. This is probably worth a buck. For the Atari 2600 gaming system, E.T. Phone Home. So the story of this was the movie E.T. was about to come out. This is back in 1982. And Atari, which had made quite a bit of money on... remember, the 2600 was very primitive. It was really the first very popular game machine, I guess. And Atari had made a lot of money on other movie tie-ins. But the movie was about to come out in 6 weeks. They wrote this game, produced the cartridge, and got into stores in 6 weeks. Well, as you might imagine, it was not only a terrible game, but full of bugs, full of holes, full of problems. It was so embarrassing to Atari, it started to hurt sales. And rather than let it continue to hurt sales of the Atari 2600, they took all the remaining cartridges, and it is rumored, never confirmed, that they buried them with a bulldozer in a landfill in New Mexico. An archaeological team has actually been looking... looking for the landfill. and they remember Geraldo Rivera with Al Capone's vault? It's like that. They're hoping that they can find this landfill. It's in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And they're hoping, maybe Ricky knows something about this. Ricky, have you gone down to Alamogordo to check out the ET landfill?
I have searched and I have failed. Didn't they make more copies of that game than there were consoles?
Oh, that was an interesting story. I didn't hear that part.
I saw a documentary,
The
History of Video Games on PBS a while back.
Yeah.
I believe it said that they made more cartridges than consoles existed, so I'm not sure who...
It's kind of reached urban legend status, but they buried 3.5 million copies of the game. New York Times said so in 1983. So there was a documentary. Fuel Industries is going to dig around. They got the rights to dig around for 6 months. This is from June, so presumably the digging is done, to try and make a documentary around this and find it.
I hope they find it. That'd be fun to see.
Wouldn't that be funny? Well, I have in my hands one of the unburied copies. You're in Albuquerque, up the road a piece. What can I do for you, Ricky?
Well, a few weeks ago, I called about suggestions on a new television for the family.
Yes. Did you buy?
Yes, I did. I actually bought two.
So what did I say? What did I tell you?
I initially said plasma, and I guess I barked at the idea of plasma because of the altitude, so I bought an LCD.
Right. Plasma plasma is only good at sea level, really.
Right.
I think they might make plasmas that are for high altitude, but...
I'll get to that. After seeing the LCD, I saw it kind of bright, especially in dark settings. So I returned it, and I bought a Panasonic plasma. And the only reason why I bought the plasma is because I called Panasonic and asked for what their altitude ratings were, and it was at 7,200 feet.
Oh, that's high. What is Albuquerque?
It's around 5,000, so I was well below it.
The issue is that plasma TVs work based on little tiny cells filled with plasma gas. An electrical excitation gets that gas to emit light. And, of course, if the air pressure is low at a higher altitude, that gas tends to escape. It's pressurized inside those cells at sea level pressure. It tends to leak out. And so over time, at altitude, plasmas will fade faster than they would at sea level.
Right.
So but that's good. It really is depending on, how the gas is pressurized. So there's no reason why they couldn't say, we'll make one for 7,200 feet.
LG actually has their plasmas at around 9,000 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. And
tell me, do you like it?
I like it. The blacks are truly black, as many people say, and it really makes the screen pop.
Yep.
I do have two issues with it, though. One is, the monitor is around 100 hours into its using.
By the way, it breaks in a little bit, so it will get better with time.
Great.
Yeah.
I noticed that anytime I leave a network logo, especially like a high contrast network logo for maybe 15 to 30 minutes, that there is a little bit of that image retention.
Yeah, but it fades.
Okay.
So image retention was a big problem with plasmas. In fact, way back when we started Tech TV in 1998, we bought plasma TVs. They were only 50-inch displays, $10,000 to put in the lobby and on the sets and so forth. And within a few years, they had faded dramatically. And because we left them on Tech TV, they had a very discernible Tech TV logo burned in the corner. Now, nowadays, stations tend to move those, they call them bugs, those little MTV logos or whatever. They try to move the bugs around for this reason. But also, plasma manufacturers have gotten very smart about preventing burn-in. Burn-in is still a potential issue, but they do things like dim the screen after a certain period of time and so forth. It really is only a big problem if you're playing I'll give you a really good example, playing a video game and you pause it. And you just leave it there. Absent anything that the screen does to protect itself, it would really burn in those controls, and it would be very, very annoying. Have you noticed that the burn-in fades out after a while?
As long as I do some other programming, so I'm balancing between watching the network news and movies.
Yeah.
I only really see it noticeable when I use a screen swipe to try and clear it out. I bought the Viera VC60.
Oh, great display. I hope you're happy with it. Now, one thing I would recommend is calibration. Scott Wilkinson, not everybody is buddies with Scott Wilkinson. I wish you all were, because Scott came over and calibrated mine. It was dramatic. Now, at first, I must say, I was like, gosh, this is dark and muted. But once you get used to it, it's true color, and it makes a difference.
I bought the Spearson Munsell just to do the basic calibration.
Good. Like that. Yeah, that's a wonderful disc. So the Spears and Munsell is a disc intended to do, it's a DVD or Blu-ray, depending on what you want to do, intended for exactly that. And I would guess you can get about 80 or 90% of the way. Yeah. It's expensive to get a pro in. It's hundreds of dollars.
So as the TV ages, that's the thing. As the TV ages, will the image retention be less noticeable? Will it retain for a less amount of time?
No, I think what you're seeing is going to stay that way. And I would be, I have nothing but plasma for years, and I've never had any permanent burn-in issues.
Okay.
So this may be something associated with altitude too. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I've never seen any burn-in problem.
I also noticed that on some motion, fast motion on the television, I see kind of like a rainbow effect.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I've been reading, and I'm not sure if it's what they call phosphor lag. I don't know if it's...
Okay, so all of these new flat panel displays, to some degree or other, have issues with action and motion. LCD most noticeably, that's why many of the LCDs have these high frame rate modes, these 120 hertz and 240 hertz modes, where they're simulating, you know, a faster screen refresh. I don't know. I've never seen a problem with plasma. It's very fast, almost as fast as a CRT. Mm-hmm. I think you're looking too hard. Relax and enjoy it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The rainbow effect is a DLP issue. You know, I wish Scott were still here, because I have never seen an issue with plasma as far as action and stuff. But I think maybe if you expect it and you're looking for it. I don't know. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Moving on up. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. I have not seen any artifacts in my plasma at all. So no rainbow artifacting is typically for a DLP display. I haven't seen that. Motion is always tough for these flat panel displays, but I think plasma is very nearly as good as CRT. That's one of the reasons people use plasma, frankly. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number. Back to the phone. Sterling in Neenah, Wisconsin. Hi, Sterling. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I just want to say I've been following you since your screensaver and call for help days.
You've been following me? That's the person I keep thinking somebody's looking at me from behind. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate it. Welcome.
Well, my problem is I used to have a laptop that was dual boot Windows 7 and Ubuntu, and it died on me. So I went out and bought a new laptop, which had Windows 8, and I upgraded it to Windows 8.1. And it has UEFI on it.
And yes.
I'm trying to install Ubuntu on it.
Right.
I've tried everything I can, and I can't get it to install to be a dual boot.
It can be done, but it's a little tricksy. You have to go into the UEFI settings and change some stuff.
I have done that. I've tried it in the UEFI mode. I've tried it in legacy mode.
That's the thing. UEFI is designed to be secure boot protected. So, and that's a good thing. That means some bad guy can't modify your... I keep wanting to say BIOS. UEFI is not BIOS. It's firmware. But if somebody modified your firmware without your knowledge... In fact, remember, last week we saw a whole bunch of NSA slides about how they were able to basically hack any hardware, and in many cases, persistently... by modifying the BIOS, by changing the firmware on the computer, so that even if you erase the drive and you reset the hard drive, even put a new hard drive in, the BIOS, which is the firmware and is always there, would reinfect the computer as soon as you install the operating system. So UEFI is designed to kind of prevent that, but it also, and this everybody pointed this out when Microsoft announced that Windows 8 was going to support secure boot, that this would effectively prevent what you want to do, dual booting. So you've looked up what I would... I don't know the answer for your specific situation. I know I was able to get Linux to run on my my Acer S7, which had the same UEFI and Windows 8 and all of that stuff.
Yeah, mine's an Acer M5.
Yeah. So what I did was disable secure boot. You say you tried that.
Yeah, I tried that, and I get the initial screen where it says, ask if you want to just run from the USB or install it. And which either option, it goes for a little bit, and then the screen just goes black, and it like stalls out, and that's it.
Yeah. Sounds like it's working. all I can say is Google Acer M5, Windows 8, dual boot, and if there's a solution, somebody will have put it up on the internet. That's the beauty of the internet for this kind of stuff. But it was always an issue. It was always an issue. That people knew that was going to happen when Microsoft went to this secure boot technology. Chat room fly on the wall saying, turn off secure boot, change it back to legacy, which emulates BIOS. You can always do what the first choice, which is boot from the USB key and run Linux.
Yeah, I've tried that. It still stalls.
It won't run. Now, that may be another... Then, okay, so maybe we've pinpointed another issue. The UEFI will not prevent you from doing that. So maybe we've identified another issue here. Perhaps there is a hardware incompatibility or a driver incompatibility. That is one of the reasons I love the idea. Linux, we should explain, is a free operating system based kind of loosely on Unix. A lot of people like it, and I love the idea of dual booting so that your Windows machine can be Windows when you need it to be, but you can also try out Linux. And most Linux flavors, which are freely offered on the Internet, including Ubuntu, which is the one he's using and is the most popular, have this great method of kind of try before you buy of booting up from a USB key, running. You could do it from a CD. Originally, it was like what they called live CD. Now you can do it off a USB key because most devices don't have CDs anymore. You run it, and as if you're running, you know, it's running the operating system. It's slower as a result because you're running it off a CD or a USB key, but you can at least see if it works. Now, if you use the live boot and it doesn't work, then we got to work a little bit on it here. So I would guess that your best bet is to get out on the internet and see what other people with M5s and Ubuntu have done. Jabba in our chat room says some Linux distributions, that's what they call them, have UEFI certificates that you can install that would make it work. UEFI Linux works with the newest distros, but you have to use legacy mode BIOS. I am sure there's some way to get this working. So who's going to win tomorrow, Packers or Niners?
I'm sure Green Bay will.
Oh, my friend, you are so wrong. What's the are you near Green Bay in Needham?
Yeah, I'm like 45 minutes south.
Give me an idea of what it's going to be like tomorrow afternoon this time.
Well, they say tomorrow the high is supposed to be around 0 degrees.
Oh! Yeah, that will certainly help Green Bay, right? They're used to playing in the cold.
Yeah, better than Monday, though. It's supposed to be the high. It's supposed to be like minus 15 on Monday.
Holy cow. Well, you wear your cheese head. I'll wear my, I don't know, what do we Niners wear? I have a hard hat with a Niners logo. I tried to wear it in the stadium last week. They wouldn't let me wear it in the stadium.
You're kidding.
I guess they're afraid I'd bean somebody with my hard hat.
Did you see the golden nugget heads?
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Yeah. I almost bought a nugget head instead. Hey, good luck tomorrow, okay? Sterling, great to talk to you.
All right, thank you.
You'll solve this, I think. I think it's doable, but I think you have to find the right instructions. It's just very annoying, frankly. But it's done, I think, for the right reasons. As much as I would like to leap to the conclusion that Microsoft's being anti-competitive, blah, blah, blah. No, UEFI is the right way to do it. It's secure, and there are good reasons to have a secure boot. You disable it at your peril, but at least, you know, and you can disable it, but at least it's on. And for most people, that's a good thing. So I don't have really, I think that's all good and well and good. What I end up doing is using a dedicated Linux computer, frankly. That solves the problem. It's easier. But a dual boot is so convenient. The idea that you could run either operating system depending on your needs. This was something we did for years. Heck, I had triple boot and quad boot machines back in the old days when we had more than one choice of operating systems. It's kind of narrowed down a little bit. Hey, good luck tomorrow. Thank you. It's great to talk to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo. We will put in the website, techguylabs.com, Jabba's link to the help page at ubuntu.com for UEFI. Because I you know, that's the issue with UEFI. Can you get around? It stands for, get ready, the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. And it's basically the software that runs when you first turn on your computer. It has to be in firmware because it tells the computer what a disk drive is so that the computer can then load the operating system. We used to call it BIOS, the basic input-output system that's been supplanted in most modern PCs. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Look who's here. Our good buddy, travel guru, Johnny Jett. And he's freezing cold.
Oh, yeah.
The snow is coming down. Where are you, Johnny, right now?
I'm in Honolulu, Hawaii, where it's 83 degrees.
Oh, shut the front door.
I was swimming yesterday. I'm about to go swimming after this.
How nice. What a good idea for New Year's to go to Hawaii.
Well, we were supposed to go home yesterday. Actually, 2 days ago. I've changed my flight twice now.
Why?
Well, the first time we wanted to extend our trip, and then the second time my wife got sick, so she's not feeling well. So what I normally would have done, if she wasn't sick, I would have played the bumping game, because this is the perfect time of year to get bumped. You go to the airport, all the planes are full, especially a place like Hawaii, and they would say, hey, anyone want to volunteer their seat? And most people have to go home to work, but, you know, I can work anywhere. And so I would have taken the $400, $500 credit or whatever it was, each of us, and got our flights changed for free instead of spending $200 each.
So for the change fee. So this is a good, okay, does this, but it doesn't always work. It has to be a time like now when, and a very popular
spot. Flights are full. But, you know, flights are full, you know, especially on, you know, Sundays, Fridays, Mondays. All you have to do is go into, actually, you just pretend you're booking a flight and hit view seats, and it will tell you what the seating chart is. So you can see if the flight's full or not. And then when you check in at the gate, say, hey, by the way, are you looking for any volunteers?
Because we've all been sitting in the airport waiting area and heard the people come on the PA saying, we're looking for volunteers who are willing to take a later flight. And they always start low. We'll give you a free box lunch.
and now Delta has actually made it a little bit tougher, because now when you check in, even online at home or when you get to a kiosk at the airport, it says this flight is oversold. Would you be willing to give up your seat, and how much would you take? And they start at like $100.
Wait a minute. They and make an offer, or you get to say how much you'd take?
You put in what you would take.
Wow.
And then what do they say? It's like $100.
Yeah.
And doesn't go past, I think it only goes up to like $100, $200. I don't even know what it is. I have a screenshot of it. But it does not go up to $400 or $500, which you can get easily.
How much?
Four to $500. If you're going internationally, you can get up to $1,300.
Whoa!
Which my sister got last year.
So you're saying hold out. Don't take the box lunch. Often they'll say, we'll give you a free upgrade. Don't take that. Hold out for cash is what you're saying.
Get the cash. They're most likely going to give you the airline credit.
Right.
So, and what I would do, and I've done in the past, I did it last year, I took, I think it was a $500 credit, I think it was on Delta, and I waited for the next flight. You had to make sure they guarantee you for the next flight, because sometimes they could say, we'll try and get you on the next flight. You want to have a guaranteed seat assignment, and you can also ask for an upgrade, especially if you have elite status.
Hey, move the microphone away from your cheek, because it's rubbing against, I think it's rubbing against your cheek.
Okay.
There you go. Oh, much better. Yeah, you didn't shave, and I can hear it.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Sorry about that.
No, that's good. This is good information. Now, do you document this on the website?
I do. I need to write another story about it.
Doesn't the airline get mad when Johnny Jet explains on its website how to play the game?
Of course, but when they get mad, my readers get happy.
And they don't take it out on you?
No. What are they going to do? They don't pay me.
What are they going to do? Oh, I don't know. They can make your life a living hell.
Well, they could take away my miles, which would
could really they? Can
bump
they?
Me out.
Can they take away your miles?
Of course, they can take away your miles for anything.
Really?
That's why, especially like if you do like a hidden city trick, which I've talked about before.
Yes.
Let's say you're flying to Buffalo and you're in LA. Instead of pricing out, or Chicago, LA, Chicago. Instead of going to LA, Chicago, it could be really expensive. But if you price out LA to Buffalo and you notice that the connection is in Chicago and it's a lot cheaper, you know, you don't check a bag and you can go right to Chicago and get off and buy a one-way ticket. But the trick is you don't put your miles in, because if they catch you, and if you do it often, they will take away your miles.
Wow. Wow. By the way, if you want to have some fun, go to johnnyjet.com and look at his 2013 year in review. Pictures from all the things you did last year. You travel a lot. You flew 97 times for a total of 129,000 miles. 19 different carriers, 17 countries, 15 states. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was actually low for me. Usually I have at least 20 countries. I usually fly. Last year I flew 100. The year before I flew 175,000 miles. But this was good. I'm actually trying to cut back. I don't want to fly so much. I don't want to do 99 segments.
I'm trying to cut back, he says.
Yeah. My goal is always to, you know, try to go to 20 countries a year. But now my goal is more to hit 5 new countries that I have never been to.
Do you still enjoy traveling? I mean, at this point.
Of course. Are you kidding me?
Really? With that much?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I'm the luckiest man alive. I have the best job in the world. I get to travel the world and share it and try to inspire people to go out and see the world. I mean, I used to be afraid to fly. I used to be afraid to leave the house. And now I pinch myself. Even when I'm home in California, I'm like, I cannot believe I'm in California because I grew up in Connecticut.
Are you saying you did all this to treat your agoraphobia?
Yes.
Like, I don't want to leave the house, so I'm going to make myself go to 20 countries a year.
No, I saw the light. I just realized how amazing it is.
I'm seeing the light. I want to come on my way. It sounds like fun. What a great. You got a website for us besides JohnnyJet.com?
I sure do. Next week we'll talk about, I have a bunch of Twitter followers for 2014 and Instagrammers, but here's a website, iExit. So bless you. The website is iExitApp.com.
I'm sorry, Natalie's not feeling well. She's got that cold we all have.
Oh, you can hear it in the background.
iExit. No, it's not .com. How do you, what is it?
iExitApp.com.
iExitApp. Wait a minute. Let me guess. This is a map of airplane exit rows. No?
This is for road trips.
Oh.
So the free version will tell you what the next 10 major exits are.
This is great.
What kind of food, lodging, whatever.
Oh, I love this.
Pay 99 cents and get rid of the advertisements. You also see what's 150 exits down the road. And
wow.
It's good for iOS and Android, and Windows is supposedly coming soon.
What a clever idea.
Yeah, so I like this new app. And it's free.
There's some really bad restaurants on the rest stops on the East Coast. I mean, really bad. What's your favorite? Is it Stuckey's? Is it
on the East Coast?
Yeah, well,
I grew up in Connecticut, so my favorite is Dutch's.
Oh.
Have you heard of Dutch's?
Yes.
The double chili cheeseburger? Oh, my God. Growing up.
Why would you want to eat that and then get in the car for another 4 hours? That sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, my God. One time I had a double chili cheeseburger, and then my brother goes, he picks me up. He goes, we're going on my buddy's plane. And this is when I was afraid to fly a little bit. I'm in the back seat of a private plane and his buddy's doing circles.
No.
And I didn't realize your stomach really does turn. When they say your stomach, it turns. My stomach was turning.
It goes one way, you go the other. It's not good.
I will never do that again. But
worldwide, what's your favorite pit stop restaurant?
Well, one of my favorite restaurants is the most touristy spot here in Waikiki, Duke's, where I went yesterday.
Duke's? Did you go to Duke's?
Yeah, of course. I love Duke's. And locals hang out there, too, by the way. The Beach Boys hang out, especially on Sundays. But I love Duke's. And, I mean, there's so many different restaurants. I came In-N-Out Burger. Can you beat In-N-Out Burger?
No, you know what?
One by LAX.
You know what? In-N-Out. Spotting. In-N-Out's pretty good.
For plane spotting. That's the best.
JohnnyJet.com. Happy New Year. We've got a great year of travel ahead. You're going to hit 20 countries this year, you think?
I'm going to try.
JohnnyJet.com.
5 or 10 countries.
Follow him on Twitter, @JohnnyJet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More to come right after this. Dukes on the sand in Waikiki Beach. I've never been to Waikiki. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Dave is in Binghamton, New York. Hi, Dave. Leo Laporte here.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Dave.
Thanks. I'm to the rescue in the chat room.
Ah, so, Dave to the rescue. I'm glad to have you in the chat room and great to talk to you on the phone.
Thank you. And so what I'm calling about is I started a radio station online. I've always been into it. And so as a hobby, I'm doing that.
Great idea.
I play EDM, 80s, and more, or electronic dance music and more.
Now, where do you do that? Is it Live 365, or what are you using?
Right now, I'm using Radionomy, and so it's on Radionomy, because it's a great thing, you know, since it's a hobby, you didn't have to pay for that. And
the nice thing about it, they do the license fees and all of that stuff, right? So you don't have to worry about that.
Exactly.
And they help you with discovery, because, of course, if you just put it on the air on the web and nobody knew you were there, it wouldn't be any good. So Radionomy helps people find you.
Exactly. And so to try to get more listeners, like right now I have the website. I have it on TuneIn.com.
Good.
And the but I'm trying to do a iPhone and Android app.
Wow.
So what I'm seeing is, like, the SDK for Apple, it's $99 to get it. But right. Since my desktop is a Beige G3 desktop and my laptop is a 2006 17-inch, I don't have the probably the power to do an SDK. Or do
you? Oh, yeah, you do. The 2007 should be fine. That's an Intel chip in there, right?
Yes. No.
No, it's not.
Well, yes, yeah. Core Duo. Yeah, Core Duo.
Oh, that should be fine. What basically happens is you pay $99 and now you're in the developer program. And that means, I mean, you can always download the developer tools without being in the program, Xcode and so forth. That's free for all Macintosh users. But in order to develop for iOS, you need, as you say, the software development kit, the iOS software development kit. And that's right. Only available to registered developers. So you're not paying $99 for the SDK. You're paying $99 to be in the developer program, which then gives you access.
Gotcha.
To the SDK and more. But it should run. Have you tried? This is what you do. Run Xcode on your machine. Put Xcode on your. It won't run on your PowerPC processor, but it will. It should run on your 2007 laptop just fine. It's free to download, install it, and see. And if it works fine, then pay the $99 because all the SDK is tools. Not programs, but. You know, the API and so forth, the files you need. If Xcode runs okay, then Xcode runs okay.
Gotcha. Now, what do you think of those online ones that, you know, you pay a subscription for them to make an app for you, or like the free apps, but then you pay a subscription to keep it up?
Yeah, you know, that's not a bad idea because a radio app isn't really hard.
Right.
It's very straightforward. And so how much – I don't know – which one are you talking –
Well, there's a few that I was looking at, either actually using AppMaker or iBuildApp.com.
Yeah.
But I was also looking at Fiverr and Elance, seeing if I would have someone there that would be interested in doing it, too.
So those are places where you would hire a programmer. I wouldn't do that if I were you, because what you're doing is very simple. Look around for – in fact, what I would do is look at what other people using Radionomy have apps – and ask them or check and see who they're using. Because really, a radio app is very simple. It's taking a standard kind of stock application and changing a few things, like what URL to point to, album art, things like that. You know, especially because you're using a standard thing like Radionomy, just check what other Radionomy people are using. Is there a – there must be a Radionomy help forum or place
where – Yeah,
Yeah, go in there and say, hey, what do you guys use – You know, if you have a radio station and I want to do a mobile, truth is, there's another advantage to that. You could be more than just iPhone. You could be Android. You could be Windows Phone.
True.
Right? So that's the way I would do it. I wouldn't even try to do it yourself. I think you've got the right idea going to a supplier of radio style apps and having them customize it for you. As long as it's affordable. I mean, you know, I know you're probably not making any money on this. You're doing it for love.
I'm looking for the hobby. I mean, even though, like, I'm looking at my listenership right now, and it's actually at zero.
It's for fun.
But,
and you shouldn't take that to heart, although having, you know, more people know. What's your station? Tell me so I can plug it.
It's thatdamnradio.com.
Yeah, so I like the name. See, that's a great name.
Yeah, and it's like my slogan is, like, turn up that damn radio. So instead of, you
turn
know,
it up, not like, down.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's a great idea. If people like, what is it, electronic dance music, EDM, is that what that is?
Yeah, EDM, 80s, more, you know, like dance hall, I'll have anything.
That's there. A popular popular thing. You also, I see, have that dubstep radio.
Yep.
You have quite a few stations. Look at you.
Well, yeah, in the future, like, I'm trying to add different frequencies. Like, right now, I only have two frequencies, but
this is great. Radionomy just bought, I'm told, Shoutcast, which was the kind of orphaned technology that the folks at Winamp had created. It was a great radio, free internet radio system, but AOL just decided they were going to dump them. And I'm really pleased that Radionomy came along and saved Shoutcast.
Yeah, so, hopefully it builds up listenership, too.
It should. And, yeah, you hang in there. I'll tell you, you know, you do it because you love it. frankly, even if you're in the radio business, in many cases, you do it not for the money, because you love it. Somebody was asking me, he said, I want to get into radio. How do I get in radio? And, you know, in my day, which was a long time ago, I bet, Heather, you have a similar experience. You would start out, not so long ago, but you'd have a similar experience. You start out at a small station. You work your way up. I started in Monterey, California, at the smallest station I could find because, well, a couple of reasons. First of all, nobody will hire you at a big station. But second of all, you want to fail kind of as privately as possible. And you're not going to be good at first. You're not.
It's true.
So you want to do it in, you know, I mean, radio is kind of a public profession. This is why I think podcasting and internet radio are so great, because it's a great way for people. You got to get experience somehow. Mm-hmm. So get experience without having to get somebody to give you a job. And then you get good enough, you should be able to get a great job. You don't have to start at a 5,000-watt radio station in Fresno, California.
Where you work overnights, by the way, on the weekend.
Weekend overnights.
$10 an hour.
Yep. It wasn't that much, because the minimum wage was $3 or something when I started. This was in 1978 or something.
Okay.
And 77. You weren't born yet. But I was working at it was KMBY Monterey. It was on the bay there. They've since changed their call letters, but it was on the bay there. They had the tower was literally in the water.
Oh,
and
wow.
You were sitting across from it in what used to be an old brothel. And it was so much fun. I was doing the overnights. They said, okay, look, kid, said that guy with a cigar. You're a diamond in the rough. So we're going to give you a great job. You get 1 hour on the air, and then you get to run religious radio, you know, church services Sunday morning for like 8 hours tapes. But that's how you used to have to do it. Now you use the internet, and you'll have a bigger audience almost instantly. Don't let the zero in the audience counter worry you. You're starting out. You're starting out. Well, hey, how are you today? Hour number 3 of the Tech Guy program at 8888. Ask Leo. It was all the rage on Facebook this week. Everybody's stunned and amazed by the accuracy of this New York Times questionnaire, How Use Guys Talk. New York Times, I think, was extracting this from an actual academic study. I'm not sure where it came from originally. A 25-question multiple-choice survey. And it was, I would say, this was the meme of the week on the internet. You answer these 25 questions, and then it made a map of where you were from based on the regionalisms. Did you take it? Now, we were starting to take this with you, Heather, but Jeff took it. He said it was right on and pinpointed you from Philly, because Philly is pretty distinctive. So, for instance, Jeff, when you address a group of two or more people, use guys, use, yuns, yins, how do you say it?
You guys.
You guys. We say you guys in California, too. It got hokey. What do you call a large wildcat native to the Americas? A mountain lion, a cougar, a puma, a mountain cat, panther, catamount, mountain screamer, painter, or other? Mountain lion. You'd think this is kind of universal and standard, and it's not. When you take it, you go, well, wait a minute. No, everybody knows it's a mountain lion. You go through it, but it's not, because for instance, do you say soda, pop?
Oh.
Soda? Now, you're from Chicago.
That's a big one.
What do you?
I still say pop, and
pop.
People go, pap.
It's a pap.
I'm like, yeah.
Do you pronounce C-O-T as in the bed that you would lie on, a temporary bed you'd lie on, or C-A-U-G-H-T as in, you know, to catch a thief? Different or the same? Say both words.
Caught.
Is that different, right?
It's different.
Some people, caught and caught, are the same. That's me. Caught. See, now, you and I are radio announcers. We've trained ourselves to not have any regionalisms. This all came up because you confessed something, didn't you, Heather Allman?
Mm-hmm.
That you don't normally speak in this polished, posh tone. Where are you from? You're from the Midwest.
Mostly the Chicago area, yeah, but there was enough time spent in Minnesota as well.
So you're saying that this is not how you talk normally? Or you do now, but you trained yourself not to sound like you're from the Midwest.
That's correct. When I moved here, I started dating a guy that was also in broadcasting, and he was from the Chicago area, and he gave me a worksheet. to work words on to my work dialect.
On. Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
So when something is across the street from you at an intersection, kind of diagonally across from you, kitty corner, kid a corner, cat a corner, catty corner, kitty cross, kitty wumpus, diagonal, or I have no term for this. Literally, these are all U.S. regionalisms that can pinpoint exactly where you're from. And you say kitty corner.
Yeah. I feel like we do here in California, too.
California is a mishmash. I don't know if this works in California because we're kind of all from all over, right?
Yeah.
I say actually catty corner.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Maybe that makes me, you know, because by the way, it totally didn't work for me. It said I was from Delaware, which I'm not. Totally didn't work for me. I've never even been to Delaware. Maybe I have. I don't know. I drove through it once.
Going to Delaware.
But see, here's my problem. I grew up in, I was born in New York, grew up in Providence, and then in high school moved to California. So I am a mess. And then I'm a radio announcer. So, you know, as you say, we kind of try to, you know, smooth out the difference, which I think is a shame.
Oh.
Don't you love it when somebody's, you know, like Ditka, sounds like they're from Chicago. I watch Monday Night Football and John Gruden, who must be from the Philly area, he's just got this great mid-Atlantic accent. And I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I wish, it's a shame we've lost all those dialects.
Well, I love it when people from New York call, like, don't we always have Peter in Brooklyn? Oh, yeah. I love his voice.
And then there's this guy, Aaron B., calls from Arizona. He sounds like he should be in Brooklyn, so it's a very confusing thing. Let's go back to the phones. 8888-ASK-LEO. Edward in Northridge, California. Hi, thanks for calling. Leo Laporte, the
Hello,
tech guy.
Leo.
Hey, Edward.
We have a couple things in common I've discovered past half hour listening to you. My wife thinks I'm the meanest guy in the world. And I have this damnable cold that I can't get rid of.
Oh, it's awful. This cold, this winter cold is a lingerer.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you feel better. Are you doing anything to take care of it?
Well, I thought it was better twice.
And yes.
Every time I went out and started to do the regular things again, I got sick again.
Yeah, I agree. So it's time to just sit back, watch TV. Fortunately, there's a football game on a little later.
Be boring. I got some problems trying to set up an HD PC. I'm just trying to learn about the equipment and the pitfalls and holdups that they present from the cable company. I set up a HD PC that I built in
when you say, and I should explain this so people understand, it's a home theater PC, a computer dedicated often in the living room to showing video.
It's just a regular PC, and I'm trying to equip it to be able to.
Right. Do you want to record? Do you want to make it a TiVo or a DVR? Yeah, see, that's the hardest thing.
I want to replace the cable box with it and record.
Okay.
Play.
So replacing the cable box is a little tricky because you have to have the cooperation of the cable company. The cable company uses the cable box basically to restrict who can watch whatever's on that cable. Otherwise, you know, somebody just go, you know, tap into the cable and watch everything on there. So they encrypt, scramble the data that's on the cable and require the cable box to unscramble it. Now, a TV or their PC can do the unscrambling. That's not hard. The issue is more getting the permission of the cable company to do it. And there was a technology created by the Federal Communications Commission in conjunction with the cable companies called Cable Card. And by law, the cable company is supposed to give you a cable card. It's a special PC card. Remember PC cards? Do you even have PC cards anymore? Well, a HTPC should. That you stick into a cable card, a PC that allows, first of all, associates that PC with your cable account. So you're going to need a, when you build an HTPC, if you want it to work as a cable, as a set-top box, you're going to need the hardware in that PC that will work with cable card. Part one. Then you got to somehow convince your cable company to give you one. This is required by the Telecommunications Act of 1996, but most of the time the cable company just pretends they never heard of such a thing. Or they keep it in the back room. You really have to ask for it. There is a new standard that's better than cable card. That's two-way, because cable card was not two-way, and that's one of the reasons that cable companies don't want you to use it, because you can't do the video-on-demand stuff that makes them so much money. So there are newer services. I guess what you should do before you do anything else, since you say you want to work with your cable company, is call your cable company and tell them, I want to build a home theater PC, and I want to see if I can make it work as a set-top box. Truckee in the chat room says, the cable companies don't have to give you a cable card. They just have to make it available. That is the fine kind of distinction that they totally take advantage of. They don't have to give it to you. They just have to make it available. So call your cable company. You're going to have to, you know, really kind of maybe wheedle with them. I find if your cable company has a storefront, Comcast in our area does, often that's the best thing to do. At least my experience has been when I go to their store, there's a guy there who's really smart, who understands this. A lot of the reps on the phone will say, I don't know what you're talking about. But the guy does. The guy says, oh, yeah, yeah. And he'll, you know, usually they want to help you. Don't you find that when people are in person, they're often nicer and helpfuler, more helpful? So that's what I would start with. Then you have to get the hardware that'll support the cable card, a tuner card that works with the operating system, and the software. Easier to get a TiVo, frankly. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And you see in our chat room the range. Of course they could charge for a cable card, just as they charge for a set-top box. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK Leo. Thanks to the chat room. They've recommended for our last caller who wanted to do a home theater PC a really cool little box from a company called Silicon Dust. SiliconDust.com. It's called the HD Home Run. They have a variety of them, but the one you'd probably want is HD Home Run Prime. So it's a digital cable tuner. See, this replaces your set-top box. Supports cable card. So you'd have to get one of the new M-Card cable cards from your cable provider. You plug that into the $200 Home Run Prime, and now you can watch and record all the digital cable channels you subscribe to in perfect quality. It works with Windows Media Center. It works on an Xbox or a PlayStation. This is definitely the easier way to do it. It doesn't replace the PC. You'd still need a PC. But it simplifies getting that PC to see TV, which is hard to do. And a lot of the difficulty comes from the fear of piracy, frankly. Not only pirating the cable signal, but pirating the movies the cable company plays over it. So there's all sorts of restrictions that the Hollywood puts on the cable companies about how they can deliver this content. They're deadly afraid that, you know, you're going to set it up and burn DVDs and send them out. Put a blanket out in the back lawn. Hey, there is good news if you're an NFL fan. It turns out that they are going to be streaming. NBC and CBS have announced they're going to do free streaming of the playoff games. And Fox, which has the rights to the Super Bowl, is going to do free streaming of the Super Bowl. Hey. Hey. Naturally, there'll be all sorts of restrictions. But that's the news, anyway. They are saying that our 49ers, who will be playing in Green Bay tomorrow, may be playing in the coldest game ever in the NFL. Oh, gosh. That does seem to favor the Green Bay team, since they perhaps are more used to that kind of weather. Certainly our Niners are not.
Ah, scary.
Last game the Niners played, Candlestick, I was there Monday, last Monday. It was balmy. I was wearing a tank top.
Yeah.
Well,
no. That is such a good look.
Not an image that you really want to think about. Hey, 8888, ask Leo. It is a mess, and I think the fear of piracy is the biggest complication in getting your media the way you want it. That's really all people are. And I've been giving speeches for years. I remember giving a speech to HBO in Florida 10 years ago. They did not like this speech. They said, whatever you do, don't talk about piracy. So what did I talk about? You know me. Piracy.
Did you wear a pirate hat?
Arr, me
just
mateys.
To drive the point home?
Arr, let me tell you about pirates. I said, and I've said this for years, all Let me tell you what your customers want. We want to watch whatever we want, whenever we want, on any device we want. We don't want all the hairball complications. The problem, I think, is that these content companies, rightly or wrongly, I believe wrongly, feel that if they make this stuff available without any protections, they'll make no money. And in fact, the number one pirated movie this year was The Hobbit. The number one pirated TV show was Game of Thrones. Lots of people downloaded it. But I would submit the reason Game of Thrones was pirated is because you couldn't buy it. You could buy the first two seasons of Game of Thrones. They wait a year. HBO waits a year before they put Game of Thrones out on iTunes or anywhere else so that you can buy it. And I would just, what I told the companies then, what I still tell them is, why don't you try it? Just make it easy for people to buy. Eliminate a lot of these road bumps, these speed bumps. Just make it easy for them to watch what they want, when they want, wherever they want. Yes, some people will steal it. But I think the vast majority of us are honest. We like the content we're getting. We know it is expensive to make. Game of Thrones, millions of dollars an episode. We know that. And we will gladly pay for it if you give us the chance. If you don't, or you make it very difficult for us to watch it how we want to watch it on our tablets or, you know, on our cable box, on our home theater PC, it is very, the competition is the free piracy. And it's very easy to figure out. And by making it so hard, really what's happened is they've taught many, many people who wouldn't be pirating how to do it. It's too bad. It really is too bad. I wish it had come out differently. I know in the long run it will be that way. But meanwhile, we have to deal with very arcane copy protection techniques that make it hard mostly for honest users. That's really my point. I've said this before. Copy protection, this kind of stuff doesn't stop pirates at all. Else, why would Game of Thrones be the most pirated TV show of the year? Because it's easy. All copy protection does is annoy and slow down honest users and ultimately teach them to pirate. I don't remember if it was a tweet or it was on Google Plus from a good friend of mine, smart guy, technologist, who'd paid for a movie. Was watching it 5 minutes before the end of the movie. He posted the picture. The movie said, had paused and said, attempting to authorize, and never did. And he never saw the rest of the movie. He'd paid for it. And he said, I paid $15 or whatever to watch this movie. I'm stuck here 5 minutes before the ending. This is why people pirate. It just teaches them to pirate. And it doesn't, this is what I don't get, the logic of it. It doesn't stop the bad guy. They know how to do this. It only stops or only hinders honest users who pay for it. And I guess the response from the movie industry and the cable companies would be, we just don't want casual piracy. You know, we don't want casual users, college kids and so forth, to steal. We want to kind of slow that down. Yeah, all you're doing is annoying your customers. 8888 Ask Leo. Luke in Adelaide, Australia. Hi, Luke. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey there, Leo. So I'm a high school student, and we have a one-to-one laptop program for a couple of years. Now, our government, my understanding is our government is pretty much ending the program. So my school is doing a bring-your-own-device kind of system.
Wow. Does the government say why they're ending the program? Is it too expensive?
I don't believe they have, and I think that might be the reason. Now, I wanted to get your opinion on it. Do you think it's a good idea, for students to encourage them to bring your own laptops and devices?
Well, here's the deal. I'm on the board of trustees of a local independent school here in the Bay Area. Yeah. My kids went there, and it has a one-to-one laptop program. It is a very expensive program, I might add, for the school. But they believe, and I think rightly so, that part of high school education includes literacy, digital literacy. And nowadays, everybody needs a computer for writing papers, for researching papers, for learning how to use the internet, and even, I don't think this is a minor thing, how to be appropriate in the use of the internet, how to keep the internet from distracting you, how to keep a computer from distracting you. This is all very important stuff for people your age to learn. However, it's very expensive.
Right.
It's very expensive. So the alternative to bring your own device has a couple of problems. First of all, the main point of a one-to-one program is not everybody can afford a computer.
And, yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one reason that I've kind of thought about it.
Yeah, kids, I mean, if everybody has a computer at home, then it's much less important to teach digital literacy. But if not, but not everybody can afford it. Secondly, of course, multiple devices, multiple operating systems, a variety of security policies is a nightmare for IT. I'd hate to be supervising that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Before the break, we were, what were we talking about? Now, I've forgotten completely. It was only 3 minutes ago. Do you remember, Jeff? Good. At least Jeff doesn't remember either. I wanted to kind of follow up. Oh, yeah, the one-to-one laptop program. So we were talking to our caller from Australia. His school, apparently a public school, government-funded, they're stopping the one-to-one laptop program. They didn't say why, but I imagine because of the great expense. But proposing in its place a bring-your-own laptop program. You know, I would be fine with that. If I think this would work, this is certainly a way to cut costs. You say to the kids who have a laptop, bring yours. If a kid does not have or cannot afford a laptop, you supply one. Now, that's going to cut your costs a lot and make sure that everybody has access. And that's the key with a one-to-one program, is it gives kids who don't have computers at home a chance to an equal playing field, a chance to learn how to use them through the aegis of the school. It also allows a teacher to create curricula that require digital technology, which I encourage. It's a good idea. Schools can use, you know, online software like Moodle or Blackboard.com to support them with, you know, examples, instruction, homework help, assignments, that kind of thing. There's a big problem with, of course, a heterogeneous environment because you got some kids bringing Windows, some Mac, some Unix, some older computers, some newer computers. And that means that you're going to spend some money on IT support. You're going to have smart IT people who know how to make these various devices secure, make them work together. You probably will have a minimum requirement. You might even say, and I know this is the case in many universities, we reserve the right if you bring your, you know, and universities don't provide laptops in most cases, but they know the students, so in most cases, bring theirs. They do say, we reserve the right, if you're going to use our network, to put an antivirus on your system, to examine your system, we have IT support for you. If you have a problem, if you have a virus or malware in your system, we'll help you remove it. That's not just for the student. That's for the health of the network. So all of those things have to be implemented properly. I'm particularly concerned about the malware implications. Kid brings a computer in perfectly healthy, puts it on the school network. He's doing his homework, comes home. And just like, you know, kids bring home colds from school, you don't want them to bring home CryptoLocker. That's not good. So there has to be some pretty good systems in place. On the other hand, I think it could work, and it probably would be a money saver. Because many people nowadays do have laptops. Many kids, high school students, do have laptops, do have computers at home. So let those kids, they've already bought them, let them use theirs. And then we'll buy them for the kids that don't have them, and we'll provide the support and services necessary to make sure it's safe and works. You know, the biggest problem, the biggest expense in schools these days is training the teachers. Some teachers are a roadblock. Some teachers welcome it. But in any case, you've got to give them the resources so they can learn how to use this stuff, how to incorporate digital technology into their education. But I think done properly, this is important. Don't our kids need to know this stuff? Don't they deserve to be taught this stuff? And again, not the least of which is how to live in a world where you're constantly bombarded by distractions from the computer. This is one thing that does make me mad. A lot of schools ban YouTube and Facebook in the school, and I understand why, but I kind of almost want to say, you know, what you need to do is teach them to turn it off, not to use it. How to handle these distractions. Because as soon as they get out of school and there's no IT guy saying you can't go on YouTube, guess what? They're going to live there. So maybe it'd be a good time now to get them and help them learn how to handle that. Harry is next. He's in Long Beach, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Leo.
How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. What can I do for? Well, I'm you know, I'm got a cold, but we all do, don't we?
Sorry to hear that. Yeah, we're fighting it off, too.
Yep.
But it's a beautiful day here in California.
Oh, yeah, isn't it? We are so lucky. Let's not rub it in to our confreres living in the Midwest and the East Coast under 10 inches of snow. Oh, well.
Hey, I was calling to see if you had any thoughts on something that's very important to us, my wife and I, and a number of other parents, in terms of parental care or parental control on kids' use of the internet. We have a daughter, 10 years old. She's a great kid, but she's an addict of Minecraft. And so we've...
She's not alone, by the way, in that age group.
and it's a good tool, but it's kind of consuming. And so we've been looking around to try and find a way to better manage that. And we came across a particular software application, just wondering if you'd heard of it. It's from a company called Nice Kits. It's called Time Boss. And
it's kind of a cool idea. I love the Time Boss. I'm kind of surprised that they're still around.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the idea is they used to be a hardware tool, which I really liked and advocated. It was a way to manage kids' use of the television. They'd get a little card. When they did good things, they could charge it up and they could get more hours of TV. In order to turn on the TV, they'd have to plug the card into a little reader device that was attached to the television set. I think now they're all software. And I'll give you the general issue. I don't, know specifically about Time Boss.
Yeah.
A couple of them. First of all, and this is exactly what we were talking about before, it's a teaching moment. And sometimes using a mechanical tool doesn't teach the kid the time management skills. Now, a 10-year-old, it's hard to teach time management skills.
That's for sure.
Yeah. It's hard. And as a parent myself, and my kids are 18 and 21 now. And
2 hours.
2 hours. That's nothing. That's nothing. A couple of things I would say. First of all, we as adults have to be sensitive to the fact that our kids are growing up in a new culture. And what we did, maybe you spent hours on the phone, for instance, as a teenager. What we did, or you went to the mall, is different from what this generation is going to do. But it's the same basic thing. It's how they socialize. It's how they learn. And now, admittedly, software developers, particularly game creators, have come up with highly addictive scenarios. Frankly, the fact that she plays Minecraft seems to me light years better than if you'd said she can't stop playing Candy Crush Saga. Nothing to learn at Candy Crush Saga, and designed to be highly addictive. Many adults are addicted to it. Minecraft, she's building stuff.
Yes, she does.
She's creating stuff. If you had a kid who spent 2 or 3 hours a day building Lego models, you might say, hey, that's not so bad.
They have a survivor mode, though, that teaches them other things.
Yeah,
like,
it's basically
stuff.
It's a game. It's a game. You're shooting stuff, and you got creepers at night and so forth.
Yep. They love it, though.
They love it. Every kid I know at that age group, not every, but almost all, are Minecraft fanatics. I have mixed opinion. You want to limit screen time. I don't think using software to do so is the ideal way to do it. If it's the only way, that's fine. And there are other tools. I like the idea of perhaps using, and I've mentioned before, opendns.com. This modifies your router instead of modifying her computer, which makes it harder for her to get around it.
Okay.
If there's software sitting on her computer, 10-year-old, she's not going to figure it out. In 3 years, she will, and she'll get around it. Okay? The other thing, there's always this risk. You prohibit something, it makes it more attractive.
That's true. And so part of the reason for the call, Leo, is really just to bounce some ideas off you and get your view, because managing it from a parent standpoint, it's an evolving story.
It is. And I will never, ever judge a parent for using whatever tools they need, especially if your kid starts getting in trouble. Their schoolwork is suffering.
Fortunately, she's still very good in schoolwork.
I bet you she's a very smart kid. The kids I see who really get into Minecraft tend to be very bright kids. And this is a world that they can... Remember, you're 10 years old, you're powerless. When they discover the computer and they discover things like Minecraft, suddenly they can be powerful. And it's a really... Of course it's addictive to... Of course they want to do this. So it's a question... I think it's a teaching moment. It's a chance for you to interact with your child. Talk about limits. Talk about your concerns. At 10 years old, they don't have a lot of rational brain power. So you might have to use, things like filtering software. I don't think that's wrong, but I would strongly encourage still having the discussion and saying, look, we understand you love this game and we think it's great that you play it, but we'd like to limit it to whatever, 2 hours a day, whatever you decide. My parents did that. They said you can watch TV for an hour a day. Oh, they've interrupted us with an ad, so I don't know where we got cut off there.
Okay.
But I'm still talking to you, so.
That's great. I appreciate
it. I could continue to talk, but the radio audience suddenly disappeared magically. I do think that, let me turn that down. I do think this is a great big challenge. And yeah, I think the Time Boss is fine. OpenDNS is fine. It's fine to use those tools. But also, I think it's really important to talk.
And that's a big part of it, Leo, because we're going to transition to sixth grade next year, and she's a girl, and everybody's pushing for phones. And so, you know, as you've been talking about, educating kids how to use the internet and phones and not get too distracted,
yep.
We're going to enter that world in big time next year. And so part of the conversation here was just to get your thoughts in general so we can better be prepared on helping her learn to adapt to that social media stuff.
Exactly. I mean, part of the problem is we're culturally from a different era.
Very.
And we have to understand. So, you know, I don't have a kid anymore, but I have adult kids, but my girlfriend has an 11-year-old, just got an iPhone. He's a fifth grader. And she's spending time, and it's really interesting to watch, teaching him texting etiquette, because he suddenly discovered texting, and he loves it.
Hmm.
And so he needs to, now this is something that we didn't have to know anything about. But he does. He does, right? So I think that it's not a bad thing to give them these opportunities. Let them make mistakes. Let them fail, but work with them. Look, Michael, this 11-year-old, he spends a lot of time on the screen, more than I would probably let my own kid do. But every parent has to deal with this in their own way because it is a challenge. The challenge for us is we didn't grow up in this environment.
No, it's very much evolving.
And it's different. My 18-year-old had different habits than my 21-year-old.
And you know what's ironic is it is, I think, intended mostly for more social activity, but in a way it kind of isolates people.
Yeah, and this is what I'm really torn about, because this is their new social interaction. I think the best thing to do is to organize real-world experiences as best you can, right?
Sure.
And make them as attractive as possible. Have play dates, although Michael have play dates, and sometimes he and the other kids will all be on their own screen. That's the play date.
Yeah,
that's so weird. And I don't know if that's healthy or unhealthy. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
And this is, we're all trying to solve this together. Yep. It's a different world. They will very much be working this way. I look at the people at work. They're all on their own screen, right? This is the workplace, too.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to form teams and solve problems online, like in World of Warcraft or Minecraft, is actually a skill they will use for the rest of their lives, because that's how people work today. So I'm not. It's hard for me to say what's useful, what's not, what's healthy, what's not. You know, it's your child. You know if this is unhealthy. They're getting pale. They're losing weight, or they're gaining weight. They're not going outside, and that's what every parent has always had to deal with. You know,
yeah.
Go outside, play.
Absolutely. And we're fortunate to live in an area where that's possible.
Yeah. Good. Good.
So, hey, we really appreciate your help, Leo.
Hey, I don't know if I help Harry, but at least we're in this. We're all in this together.
Yep. Thanks. Always listen to you. Yeah.
Thank you, Harry. Take care. Yeah. I mean, I really love the idea of kids playing with other kids, looking at each other, talking, learning interpersonal skills. And I think the best thing a parent can do is perhaps encourage that by providing opportunities for that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That really is a fascinating cultural gulf. I guess when I grew up, you know, the generation gap. We all talk about the generation gap and never trust anyone over 30 and cut your hair. So there's always been this difference between youth culture and grown-ups. But boy, the gulf seems bigger now because of digital technology and the speed with which it has evolved. You know, smartphones. When my kids were growing up, they didn't have smartphones. That's a new thing. My 21-year-old, Abby, spent a lot of time in instant messenger. There was no texting. It was instant messenger. And then by the 3 years later, when Henry's growing up, it's Skype. It's group video calls have replaced instant messenger. And now it's Minecraft. And they're talking to each other. You know, they've got headsets. They're talking to each other. It's social. They're not in the same room. It's very hard for us to keep up with this thing. We're not biologically designed to have everything change every few years. And yet, there's one man who has. There's one guy who's now 143 years old, and yet he has the spirit and joy of a young person. I'm talking about Dick DiBartolo, the Gizwiz. You are a cultural forerunner, Dickie D.
Absolutely. You know what, Leo? It's so funny because today is the first day I'm using my 1200 board modem. Last week I was on the 300
Isn't
board.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Can you see the difference? Can you hear the difference?
Look at how the text goes right across the screen almost as fast as you can read it.
Amazing.
Wow. Someday,
yes, exactly.
Someday maybe we'll even be faster than we can read. No, that'll never happen.
Nah, never happen. Never happen.
You may one know day the name.
We'll be able to see each other.
Oh, no. Video. No. That's crazy talk. That's the future.
It is.
That'll be
it
in
is.
The year 2010. Wait a minute. Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer. He's been a gadget hound since the days of when the first answering machine appeared.
Yeah, when Alexander Graham Bell said to me, "What do you think?" I said, sounds like gadget warehouse material to me.
every week he joins us with a great gadget. Happy New Year. You were so fun on New Year's Eve.
That whole show was great, Leo. That was just great.
I will indelibly print it on my mind, the image, while our New Orleans jazz band live in studio is playing out 2013 with a dirge and then playing in 2014 when the Saints come marching in. And Dickie D, with his light-up glasses that say 2014, blowing his horn. It was via Skype.
Via Skype, yes.
It was amazing.
Exactly.
I'll never forget that image. Anyway, yeah, we had a lot of fun.
As much as you try.
But that is amazing. Here you are. You're in New York. We're in California. We were able to basically party together.
No, absolutely. I had my mirrored ball. It was great. It was great. You know, I would have come out, but like the first of the year is the boat show. And after writing my boating column for 42 years, I know so many people at the boat show.
Oh, you have to go. And, of course, International CES, the big consumer electronics show, starts Tuesday. When are you coming out to Vegas?
I am flying out. I'm leaving here at 6 a.m. tomorrow.
Are you looking forward to it? Do you think you'll see things that will
blow
your mind?
You know what, Leo? It's very funny. And I thought we'd just talk about CES in this spot. To save time, I know so many PR people now. I tell them, send me stuff under embargo. I'll honor the embargo. And that way I sort of know what's coming down the pike.
But you can't
without
tell
mentioning
us.
Any names. No, but Leo, it is more and more Bluetooth speakers.
Right.
59 new ways to hang an iPod from your shower rod, from your dashboard.
You see, this does not impress me. I don't care.
No, no, no.
This is not helping me or changing my life.
No.
It's just more junk.
Cloud storage, about 10 new cloud storage systems. You know, I'm going to have to buy more content because there's too much cloud storage. I can't supply it all.
You know what's really the case is that this industry, like every industry, has a big Me Too component. That if somebody comes up with an idea that sells, they're going to be guaranteed within a year a bunch of knockoffs and copies.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean there's no innovation. There can still be innovation.
Leo, I will tell you about one thing. I wrote this PR lady and said, it's the one thing I must see. Oh, it's called Panono. P-A-N-O-N-O.
Panono?
No, not the no-no that, like, burns your hair
off. By the way, there's a new no-no pro. I'm tempted.
You had such wild success with the other one for only $369.
Yeah, three easy payments.
Yeah, well, this is about $100 more than that, but this is what the Panono does, okay?
Better
it's very
something
bizarre.
Good for $400.
$500.
$500?
Okay, it's very bizarre. It's a ball with 36 cameras all around the ball.
What?
The premise here is you go to picnics, you go to parties, you have all these snapshots of people, and you say, where in the world did I take this picture? So this is what you do. At the event, you throw the Panono in the air. At the apex, all 36 cameras fire. Okay?
Oh, my goodness.
Then you download it to your iPad, and then you can move the iPad around and look all around, see where you were, who was there, where they were standing. Or you probably have a great shot of the person who threw the ball up also. It's right now.
I want one of these badly. $500.
$499.
Do you think I'll get invited to more fun parties if I have one?
You know what? Yeah, if you bring your Powerball, your 36 camera firing
then
ball.
Does the software then somehow figure out who everybody is in all my other pictures?
No, I don't think
it doesn't
so.
Do anything. I just got a one big Panono image.
Yeah, but it's different. You must admit, no one else. You know, next year we'll have 45 cameras in a basketball. But for now, this is the only company I know who's doing this. And she said, yes, we'll meet you at CES, and yes, you can throw it in the air.
Of course, I'm going to have to buy one.
That's what I thought. I said, you know, I'm going to say this is a crazy gadget, and Leah's going to say,
I wish I'd had this, actually, for our New Year's Eve party.
Oh, that would have been great. You could have seen where all the different people were lying on the floor, passed out drunk.
Yes, exactly. Dick DiBartolo's at gizwiz.biz. That's his website. All his notes from CES will be there. And, of course, next week he will join us and talk about some of the favorite things he picked up at the Consumer Electronics Show. You can also play the What the Heck Is It contest there, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. Brand new one starting this month, right?
Yeah, started the first of the year. Exactly.
So now I got to go back to Giz.
And the winner is announced for the other one. Oh, you know, you were pretty close on...
It looked like a Bluetooth. I thought it was a Bluetooth earpiece.
Oh, no, you were dead wrong. You were so far away.
What? Well, let's look at it.
The new one. Leo, that is a glass cleaner for eyeglasses. It cleans both sides of your eyeglasses at one time.
Oh, because it's so much trouble to use a handkerchief.
Yes, exactly. It's a little microfiber pad on each one of those devices.
Are we talking about the same thing?
Yeah, that little red thing.
All right. I give up. So there's a new picture. It looks like a, rubber arm or something. I don't know what it is. You figure it out. You get it right, you could win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. You get it wrong, because Dick's very democratic, you could win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, your website, gizwiz.biz, is running on Squarespace. Is
it
not?
Absolutely. It is.
You happy with it? You like it?
Very much so. I am.
This is a New Year's. We're going to do the ad. Stick around, Dick, because the Giz Fizz will come up in just a bit, okay?
Yep. With Oh My God Chad as the as the guest.
Wait a minute. The guy's name is Oh My God Chad?
OMG Chad.
Oh, okay. Is that what the OMG stands for? Actually, you know, speaking of Minecraft, he does our Minecraft show here, which is called OMG Craft. And it's a great show for Minecrafters. So if your 10-year-old's addicted, make sure she tunes in. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows and Windows Weekly, Macintosh and MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.